And good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. You know, from time to time on the show here, we have physicians to talk about dealing with healthcare problems that come up in families. Well, there's another kind of family doctor that we also like to have on the show, and that's the doctors that take care of our animal friends. And we've been very happy to have from time to time here physicians, veterinarians on the program to talk about routine questions that have to do with care of companion animals, cats and dogs mostly, but we have talked about other kinds of animals as well. And that's what we're doing this morning. It's one of those programs we call Talk with the Veterinarian. And we have two guests here. Dr. Brendan McKiernan, he's the director of the University of Illinois Veterinary Teaching Hospital, has been here since last summer. He is very well known as a specialist in respiratory diseases of dogs and cats. Scott Austin is here too. He is assistant professor of veterinary clinical medicine in the College of Vet Medicine. And he's a specialist in equine medicine. And I said before that I don't think we've ever had a horse specialist here this morning. So I reach out to all the people who are listening this morning who love and live with horses. If you have questions about horses and their care, you can call us. But also more routine kind of questions about the more common companion animals, well, they're welcome to. And I know that our two guests, between them, will do their best to help you out. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line, so that means if it would be a long-distance call, use that. That's 800-222-9455. So 333-9455 locally, and toll-free 800-222-9455. And you can also send us your questions by email if you want. will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, thank you both very much.
Thanks, David, for having us.
We certainly appreciate it. I don't know if Dr. McKiernan, you would want to say anything, you know, generally about the College of Vet Medicine and the kind of services that you provide, and in addition to training people who are then are going to go out and be vets, what would you like people to know about the college?
I'll give you a little history. It's one of the land-grant institutions. The university veterinary school started in 1952 with the first graduating class. There's been about 1,400 graduates, master's students about 500 and a half, and almost 400 PhDs granted by the college over the years. Provides all kinds of services, obviously primary care service in both large animal, Dr. Austin, also in small animal, but more importantly, sort of a tertiary referral service for specialty problems that might develop with your animals.
Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things I think is particularly interesting, is that as time has gone along here, animal care has become increasingly sophisticated, and that kind of procedures, people are doing procedures on animals that perhaps previously were done on humans, but we're not done with animals.
Absolutely. I first got here in 74, and the changes over those decades have been amazing, services that are provided. And if you have pets, you know they're part of our family, very much so.
Yeah. So it's a care resource. It's an information resource. You actually could be somebody's vet if they wanted to.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. What's just tell me your experience, Scott, and in what sort of ways do you think your special area of interest has, say, changed over the time you've been practicing?
Well, as a primary care veterinarian, you know, I travel, go to the farm, per se, see people, but I also worked in a hospital most of my career, and so we had to develop those services to have available for things that you couldn't handle in the field anymore. Mm-hmm. So the sophistication is greatly increased. In practice, we had digital radiography before the local hospital did, because the demand's there. Use ultrasounds a great deal, and have portable equipment that travels with you. So what you can deliver in the field has changed a great deal and is much more sophisticated than it used to be. A needle, syringe, a bucket, and a tube. And it used to be kind of the standards, and now you need a lot more room in your truck to carry your equipment.
Yeah, okay. Well, you know, I was thinking that maybe I would like to have Dr. McKiernan talk a little bit about respiratory issues, since this is a special area of your interest. And I'm thinking about the fact that it seems to me, at least, because of the weather conditions this fall, there are a lot of people who are experiencing allergy symptoms.
Sure, right.
And then they actually seem to be fairly intense because, you know, it got so warm and everything just went nuts all at one time.
Right.
Well, animals are susceptible as well. I'm not sure that they express it quite in the same way. But do you see animals having similar problems, or at least maybe they're similar in the sense that the agents that cause the problem are the
similar agents? Absolutely right, David. Obviously, the first thing is the dermatology that we suspect allergies, and we have a dermatology service that's extremely active for just what you described. Mm-hmm. Respiratory-wise, we do see seasonality changes as the pollen counts go up and grasses or molds in the fall or whatever happens. We'll see issues with that. A little harder to define and say this is absolutely an allergic phenomenon, scientifically an allergic, as opposed to just a local irritation, not necessarily allergy in definition. But we deal with coughing, sneezing, nasal discharge type problems, dogs and cats, and Scott probably in horses.
Yes, we definitely do see allergic type lung disease in horses. Can be very common during the summer months when it's pollen as the major driving force, but certainly in wintertime when horses are stabled, their feed materials usually close by, a lot of dust and mold, and that can stimulate very severe respiratory conditions in horses.
Hmm. So for your more routine companion animals,
mm-hmm.
what sorts of things would you be watching for? And I guess the question would be, you know, at some point, do you think that symptoms become severe enough so that you want to treat, and then if you make that decision, well, what do you do?
It's interesting. You and I be walking up and down stairs and frequently, you know, experience some respiratory difficulties, and that's pretty much of an alert for us to go and check it out. Depends on the activity of your animal. Horses are going to be riding and much more active. Scott can address that. If you have some of our pets, they may be couch potatoes. Not very active. It's going to take pretty severe disease before that begins to show up. But owners should be looking for changes in patterns of breathing, effort of breathing. Fast breathing when sleeping is a real clue. Not after exercise. We expect that. I pant and huff after a little bit. But after sleeping, if their rate is increasing, and a number we use is somewhere around 30-ish, so if a sleeping animal's rate is much above 30, we begin to think of cardiorespiratory. Could be either, affecting the lungs, the heart, and breathing. Mm. Activity, exercise. I used to walk my dog a mile and, gee, out in front of me, and now he's behind me. I've got to kind of pull him along. Something's changed. It could be cardiorespiratory. It could be arthritis. So those are kind of hallmarks to be looking for.
Well, we look at what we call exercise intolerance because most people have horses to ride. And so now if the horse doesn't have the energy, seems to cough, the cough doesn't go away with one or two clearing of the throat, then we probably have a respiratory problem that needs to be addressed. Up until then, most of the time, modifying the environment is more successful, trying to limit dust in the environment, especially at feeding time, getting them outside all the time, out of the barn. Certainly when barns are being cleaned, that's a really tough time for these horses that have allergies. The blower may be a quick way to blow the aisle out, but it doesn't help these horses that have sensitivity to that dust. So we try and get them outside, and we don't start treating really till they have signs of exercise intolerance. You can't do what you normally need to do with the horse anymore without it becoming tired.
Mm. Your question, David, was about treatment, and your management comment that Scott mentioned is critical. I try to spend a lot of time talking about management. What's at home? You have cats. What kind of litter? Is it dusty? Is it a covered box? Are there, for instance, smokers in the house? What other things besides allergy might be a factor, might be a role player here?
Well, now just let me ask you, because I live with a cat, and I think that people like the idea of a covered box just because it helps contain the litter, you know, and if you have cats that like to dig or they get in there and they're throwing stuff around, you like to try to contain it in the box. But now, is it potentially, though, a problem if it also confines the dust in there when they're in there?
Exactly. It's a potential. And we can treat with certain things, but if we're able to eliminate a managerial issue, such as a covered box, potentially. You could switch to a very high, deep box with a big side as opposed to a cover over it. And these are only theoretical things, but they're things that you can eliminate as opposed to putting on medication and treating. We can do that, but I would rather try to find the cause, if we can, an irritant, as Scott was talking about, and avoid it.
Yeah. Well, for humans, if you have allergy issues, there are a variety of things that you can do, starting with antihistamines and decongestants that are you can just go out and buy, and then there are inhaled steroids that you can get by prescription. And so there's a range of things depending on how severe the symptoms are and whether you want to get into having to have a prescription. For animals, do you use some of those same kind of medications if the symptoms are severe enough?
Well, certainly in horses, the mainstay is usually steroids, decrease the inflammation. Some horses can deal with that to a level that allows them to go back and compete. But a lot of horses that are athletic, we use the same inhalers that people use, only a lot more of them. And so the device is actually designed to fit over a horse's nose that you can put the inhaler in, so they have to inhale the particles down. You can't teach them to breathe and use their puffers, but there are devices designed to deliver these medications to allow these horses to have a more normal life. Cuts down a lot on the side effects. Takes a little bit of commitment from the owners to deliver the medication on a regular basis, but it certainly can make their life a lot easier and more tolerable for them with these medications.
And we have similar, both oral and inhaled, that have come to be used over the past, most oral medications are a long time. Early 1900s, there were some bronchodilators, for instance, that were recommended and used. And veterinary medicine, the first discussion of respiratory treatment goes back to somewhere in Egypt in the early 1900 BC time, inhaling drugs that were fumed and burnt and so forth. And that's where human medicine has come from, and better understanding of why those things work.
Let me introduce again the guest for this part of Focus. Dr. Brendan McKiernan is the director of the University of Illinois Veterinary Teaching Hospital. Dr. Scott Austin is an assistant professor in the College of Veterinary Medicine. He's a horse specialist, so certainly we can take questions about horses if there are folks out there who have them. Otherwise, we can do more routine kind of companion animal questions. That's what we're doing here this morning. We're glad that they can be here, and we're open to whatever questions you might have. You can call us. 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. If you'd like to write, you can do that too. Send an email to will-talk@illinois.edu. Just coming back to the subject of allergies, and I guess I'm thinking about dogs particularly, because one of the things that's interesting about dogs is that they express their allergies through their skin. And so you may well indeed have, you know, in a human being, maybe you've got a lot of respiratory issues that's allergy related. Well, in dogs particularly, what you're going to see is skin problems.
Very often skin, and obviously it's obvious because it's outside the dog, whereas a mild cough here and there or a little runny nose or something might be overlooked or not as obvious. It's not a reddened, oozing wound that's been scratched for a long time. Mm-hmm. But they can have intestinal problems for allergy, skin problems, respiratory problems that you just described. All of those can occur.
Here's something that, you know, it's come up and I'm – and don't know that I ever really got a good answer, but it is something that I've asked vets before. You can have cats and dogs, and you can see them. They appear to have symptoms, and if you saw those symptoms in a human, you'd say, well, that person had a cold. Because, you know, they sneeze, they cough,
right.
They have runny nose. You know, things that obviously you would say, oh, well, I know what that is. And I know that I have talked to people, again, this has been sort of anecdotal, where there's been a case where everybody in the house had a cold, and so did the animal in the house. And the question comes up, well, okay, now, could rhinovirus get passed back and forth between humans and non-human animals? Is that actually possible? Or we got different viruses that affect different species?
Definitely different viruses, different species.
Okay.
There are things that are always talked about, strep throat in kids. You know, while it's blamed on the animal in the house, animals do have strep, but it is a different strep. It doesn't cause the strep throat that people have. Occasionally, you may find that on a culture, and there's a very specific culture that has to be done, that it is the same. But most often, it's another individual in the house. It might be a silent carrier for strep. Viruses, no, we're not concerned about that.
Okay. Well, then, I guess I also had this question that if you, assuming that you have an animal, and again, I guess most of my experiences is with cats that don't go outside, so they're not having contact with other cats. Mm-hmm. So if the cat gets cold, they didn't get the cold from me. I'm not sure how they could possibly have gotten from another cat if they have no contact with another cat. I guess that what that says is that all these viruses, they're just floating around in the world, and it's very difficult not to be exposed to something.
Well, Scott's mention of the barn being cleaned by a blower and the dust being raised, those things happen in our house. We have forced air heat, for instance. And a lot of people, oh, I have to clean filters? Those can be things that circulate.
Yes.
The litter that you talked about with your cat, the covered box, is another. And different litters are sold with all kinds of dust-free. But if you ever take that bag of dust-free litter outside in a windy day, which we're having today, kind of pour it slowly into a bucket, you'll see all kinds of dust blow off. Yeah. So all of those are irritants. Cats are down, dogs are down on the floor where the dust accumulates. All of those things are definitely possible, and it's more likely that your animal, cats especially, have a more of a chronic bronchitis issue, chronic bronchial disease, than true asthma or allergic lung disease. Those are a little bit more, if we accept the human definitions of asthma, some of those are very difficult to definitively prove in animals.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, certainly it's for the comfort of all concerned and your energy efficiency, it's a good thing to change the filters on your furnace on a regular basis.
Yes.
Especially if you have long-haired pets. That's certainly something we have discussed on other programs when we're talking about home care.
Yeah. No, we could. We have some long-haired pets, and we could certainly knit sweaters with them.
Yes, I've often thought of that as being a cottage industry. I'm not sure what sort of market there would be for cat hair sweaters.
Yeah.
Maybe among people who really like cats.
Really like cats.
Other than that, I'm not so sure. Well, again, I want to tell people who are listening, we're certainly open to your questions, 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line, so that means if it would be a long-distance call, you know, use that number. That's 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. And our guests are Drs. Brendan McKiernan and Scott Austin from the University of Illinois College of Veterinary Medicine. Anything else that on sort of on this subject that you might like to mention?
Well, a lot of what I do, I could say the same thing kind of carries over in the horse world.
Yeah.
Irritants can be responsible for a lot of the respiratory signs that we see.
Mm-hmm.
Barns, ammonia buildup, and especially with the youngsters, you know, they're closer to the ground, so we will see irritation. It's a big problem in horses that work for a living. That just the activity of working in an arena that has dust and dirt, being in stall, that a lot of these horses develop respiratory signs that they're not related to viruses, they're not related to allergies. It's just the impact of all the dust and dirt that they get exposed into their respiratory system, and it creates inflammation and a chronic cough.
Mm-hmm.
And so that can be one of these chronic problems when they go out to compete, that the horse starts into these coughing fits. And it's related to the environment and the conditions that we exercise them under.
Yeah.
Chronic bronchitis is a thing that I probably deal a lot with, dog or cat. And it's defined in people as a certain frequency of coughing over a number of years, not attributable to heart disease or cancer or some other concern. But the problem becomes the cough. The irritant started it. It wasn't treated effectively. The continued cough becomes an irritant, and then it self-perpetuates itself. And there are studies done in dogs, and literally it takes, according to this one study, unfortunately the only study detailing this, but the changes on an examination in the lungs only takes about 2 months of steady coughing during 1 year to become this chronic bronchitis which self-perpetuates. So early diagnosis, early effective treatment with your veterinarian, with specialists if needed, is really the goal here.
And do you then treat that with antibiotics?
Usually, well, it depends on the inciting cause. There can be bacterial. Almost always the chronic situations are not bacterial. And Scott, on horses?
Well, most of our chronic coughs are definitely not infectious. They're environmental causes, allergies, a lot of those things.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. You know, not being a horse person, not having a lot of experience with horses, I don't think that I would be quite so sensitive to the idea that horses do spend their time in some confined or semi-confined spaces. I'm thinking of horses. Well, they're all walking around outside, but I'm sure that they'd spend a lot of their lives in the barn, so that you would have to be really thinking about what's the air quality there because they spend so much time there.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's correct. If you look at the more rural areas, yes, horses are out. Yeah. But there's a large number of horses that are in urban areas, people that are competitive riders, large barns. They don't have property to turn the horses out for most of their day. And so we end up horses in confinement situations to where they're out exercising in an arena, but they don't have a big, large pasture to turn them all out because they have such a large number of horses there. They certainly are not confined the whole time. They're exercising, they're doing everything, but there always seems to be a lid on their activities. There's a roof over the top of them. And so air quality becomes an issue over time with them.
I have an email here from somebody. This is a cat-related question.
Okay.
And it's from somebody who has a cat who is 12 and is doing well, but they want to make sure that continues to be the case. And they particularly have some questions that have to do with older cats, and one of them being about diabetes. And we're interested in having you talk a little bit about why it is that older cats seem to be susceptible to diabetes, even cats that don't seem to be overweight. Are there particular risk factors for cats in that respect?
Well, I think the answer to that probably is yes. Cats are originally carnivores. A lot of the diets that we have developed and the cats are fed are not high in protein. They're higher or have a higher content of carbohydrates, and so that can be a dietary issue. Jumping way ahead, one of the early treatments, first treatments that we will try with a diabetic animal is to move to a more carnivore-like, higher protein content diet, and many cats resolve right there. Some cats, and just as in people, sometimes diet alone can manage this. And sometimes we will have to resort to insulin, usually try to avoid that. As far as risk factors, I would say diet, being overweight. You mentioned this person's cat is not. That's good. And trying to manage it with the diet is the first starting point. Those are the main things. It's not necessarily an older animal. We do see it. If you have pets that haven't been routinely checked, we just as yourself going in for that annual blood work, I think that's probably a good thing to be considering for especially older animals. Mm-hmm. Find out if there are issues developing, try to catch them early and manage them effectively.
Yeah. I suppose, and if you're thinking about symptoms, I think of the classic things as being excessive intake of water, which you should be able to see either if they seems like they're constantly drinking or drinking a lot, and then I guess you have to look at urine output as well. So besides that, are there other signs of diabetes in cats that you'd tell people to look out for?
Those are probably the most common, David. The other would be appetite and weight loss. Very often you'll see weight loss in these animals because they aren't able to process food appropriately. If the diabetes begins to get out of control, it can lead all the way up to a coma situation, very severe thing. The drinking and the urinating are the easiest things to notice from an owner. I'm having to clean the litter box more often. The water bowl seems empty today. Mm-hmm. What's the deal? Those kinds of little things. But routine checks, just as for us, every annual examination is the way to go, and I think the same for pets here.
Yeah, this is something that I think of as being a cat issue. At least I don't recall that I have heard people talk about having a dog. with diabetes. Are they susceptible as well, or other domesticated animals susceptible?
Oh, definitely. I think very definitely. And Scott?
Well, horses don't get diabetes per se, but we see something very similar to type 2 diabetes in people, that we have obesity-related problems. The horses become insulin resistant, and high levels of insulin is related to foot pain. We call it laminitis. They actually get inflammation in their feet. It can make their lives chronically painful, related to the effects of obesity. And it's kind of the lumpy, bumpy fat horses that get fat pads because they're over-conditioned. They will get insulin resistance, and it is a chronic issue. In fact, I see a lot more horses for being overweight than I do for the thin horse that isn't doing very well.
Interesting. We talked a little bit about respiratory disease treatment. I always bring it back to respiratory things. But with diabetes, one of the concerns we have and things we use with an asthma animal or bronchitic animal are steroids. So overzealous use of steroids can lead to diabetes, especially in cats. They seem to be relatively sensitive to that. So chronic skin allergies, chronic respiratory things that we use steroids for could lead to a diabetic situation in cats. So getting the right diagnosis, minimal use of drugs if we can, managerial changes to try to avoid some of those complications.
Okay. In this part of Focus, we're looking for questions on companion animal health care. We have two guests, both from the University of Illinois College of Vet Medicine, Drs. Brennan McKiernan and Scott Austin. Sorry, Scott. And we'll talk some more with them just a moment after a short break. This is Focus.
Support comes from the Technology Entrepreneur Center, hosting an invention-to-venture workshop on the basics of technology entrepreneurship and how to commercialize technology from research on Saturday, April 14th at the Coordinated Science Lab. Registration now open. Space is extremely limited. Information at tech.illinois.edu/i2v.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We are here weekday mornings from 10 until noon, and we have 10 different topics for you every week. Always welcome your questions and comments. In the second part of the program today, we'll be talking about homelessness and what we know about it, in specifically in our part of the state, in East Central Illinois. We will have two guests, Beverly Baker, Director of Community Impact with United Way of Champaign County, and also the Reverend Irvin Williams. He's Executive Director and a pastor for Restoration Urban Ministries in Champaign. Next week on the program, on Monday, 10 o'clock, we'll have our regular monthly show on home care. Scott Spies will be here. He's a home inspector. And any questions you have about the single-family home and all of its various pieces and parts, you can certainly call in. Then next week, let me mention one other. Tuesday, we'll be doing a show talking about things that you can do and think about if you're trying to preserve artifacts and family treasures. And this is a program we've done a couple of times before. Jack Brighton will be hosting the show, and he will have two guests, Krista D.C. Quinn. She's collections manager from the Spurlock Museum on the campus, and also Jennifer Hain-Tepper, who is head of the Department of Preservation and Conservation at the U of I Library. And it's something I think people are thinking about more and more, how to make sure that those special things that they have last for a long, long time. You can check our schedule by going to the website. It's WILL.illinois.edu. Find out what we'll do in the days ahead. That way you can also listen to past programs. You can also find us on Twitter, Will Public Media. We're also on Facebook. This morning we have two guests here, both from the University of Illinois College of Vet Medicine. Brendan McKiernan. Dr. McKiernan is the director of the U of I Veterinary Teaching Hospital. He's a specialist in respiratory diseases of dogs and cats. Scott Austin is assistant professor of veterinary clinical medicine in the College of Vet Medicine, and his special area is equine medicine. He specializes in horses. He's been here since last fall. He provides primary care to farms surrounding the university. So certainly if you have horse questions, we'll take them, but it's an opportunity as well to ask more general questions. Probably most people will not have horses. They will have dogs and cats, and those questions are certainly welcome. Let me give you the numbers again, 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Can we just, I have one other question, kind of going back to the last discussion about diabetes in cats. I think that also this person was interested in anything that you might say of a general nature about what makes for a good diet in a cat that's in the 10 to 12 year age range. They're specifically say they're feeding a product, a science diet for mature indoor cats, and then also the cat gets a little bit of a moist canned food, and they make sure that the cat has access to fresh water every day. But they're wondering, well, yeah, is there more or that they could be doing, or is does that sound pretty good?
No, I think they're doing a good job in selecting a diet through their veterinarian that is targeted towards the older animal. I'm assuming that they've had a routine check, that there's no kidney issues, because then diet might be altered slightly, that all of that has been normalized or is normal. The canned food is kind of like kids. We have some regular food and we have dessert. Where do you want to start? And usually the canned foods are a little more tempting, and if they're not eating quite as readily, maybe we tend to slide over and give some of those. And those are the ones that usually are not the type of diet we would select for a diabetic animal if it was diabetic. Usually they're a little more sugar-coated, if you will. They're not as high protein content. And that's not all of them, but in a generality. The science diet and those prescription diets that are targeted towards larger, older animals, sorry, or maybe Scott, maybe larger animals, are a good way to be going, David.
Yeah, okay. I think that there probably some people think that by if they have an animal, a cat, that, or maybe also with a dog, that's mainly eating some kind of dry food, one of these kind of pellet deals, that they maybe think, well, by supplementing that a little bit with something that has some more moisture in it may be a good thing.
Actually, there have been some studies that show that on a dry diet, they drink obviously more water to make up for that.
Oh, okay.
But the content of the dry food, they don't really need to worry about that. The content probably has more controls into animal feed than some of the diets that we are on ourselves. There's more quality control, I think, in a lot of those cases.
Okay. Well, we have a couple of callers here. Let's talk with these folks, and we'll start with someone in Urbana. Line number one. Hello.
Hi, good morning. Mm-hmm. I was calling about something that is pretty much running rampant in the United States in humans, and also I have seen in a lot of animals, and that's obesity. And per what weight in a human compared to a weight in a dog or a cat or a horse, is it that what percentage of their weight do you have to take off for them to become healthy again? I know it's different between a Chihuahua and a Great Dane.
Okay, maybe you can take that one.
Okay, and we have an expert, too, with obesity with Scott here. But on the small animal side, let me go back up to a larger animal, two-footed person. It only takes a 5% weight loss to quantify respiratory improvement, for instance. So that's a pretty small amount of weight when you think about a 10-pound Chihuahua or something like that to get them dieting. You're only talking about that half of a pound. So a very small amount of weight can make a significant respiratory improvement. The same effects on cardiac, on joints, on many immunologic problems, cancer related with overweight or obesity. Unfortunately, 40 to 50% of our small animal, cats and dogs, are overweight, grossly overweight. And there's simple ways that you can check for that at home. We can talk about those if you like, David.
Sure. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. There's something called a body condition score. In people, it's the body mass index, your BMI. But that doesn't seem to work so well in animals. And what they've done through experimenting, very detailed testing, in people, you can displace water by floating in a pool and figure out. And none of that seemed to really work or be easily done in animals. What they do is you can stand, have your animal standing, stand next to them or over, and just from the sides, feel just behind their front legs, feel their ribs. If you can easily feel ribs, like your fingers almost, you'll probably have a reasonably good weight for your animal. If you have to dig hard to find that, there's an issue. If you don't see that there's a curved waist as you stand above them, you've got a problem. If there are these big bumps over their hips, those are love handles, if you will. It's a little bit excess weight there. And looking from the side, the caudal or the back portion of the belly should be curved upward. And if you're not seeing these things, you do have an issue and definitely you should check with your veterinarian. Weight is one thing that most animals cannot control if you give them free choice to feed. You need to be cautious about that. They don't open the refrigerator, and we kill, overdo our animals by giving them access and not controlling it. And it's the one thing that you have as an owner total control of.
Does that get at your question? Did you want to ask any further follow-ups?
The what percentage do you think, as far as health care expense for animals these days compared to such as in humans, it's a huge portion of you know, expense for obese people with health-related mm-hmm. issues. What is that in do you see in the animal world?
I don't think I can give you a percent, but it is a, I would say, a large percentage probably. Again, multiple organs affected by multiple diseases, at least in part attributed to obesity. Respiratory-wise, I deal a lot with the small brachycephalic, the flat-faced bulldog pug. And I would say huge costs in those animals to deal with overweight and airway issues on the respiratory side. Lameness, the best thing that you can do is get weight off of very sore joints. So weight loss there is also huge. Scott?
Yeah, I don't think that there's any figures out there would say what percent of, you know, cost is associated with obesity. I know there is an awful lot of money spent right now on companies developing diets for horses that are low carbohydrate. There have been several survey studies done that have looked at obesity in just random horses out at pasture. They did one in Virginia. They did one in England. And they just went out and looked at horses, said, Tank, can we come do body condition score on your horse? And they found that obesity was around 50% of the horses that they looked at
Wow.
are out there. So many, many of them are overweight. And part of it's related that they're used to eating grasses, hay, and we tend to feed them concentrates, which are high sugar, starch, with all of these grains. And most horses don't need them because they're relatively low exercise levels. And, you know, they used to wander around in a whole different environment. They would walk miles and miles to get enough to eat. And now we feed them simple-to-eat meals and have hay in front of them all the time. And so they tend to put on more weight. They're like a lot of us that more time sitting around doing nothing and eating during that time. And so they get big. And it leads to lameness problems. It leads to respiratory problems. And it's actually got a disease name now as equine metabolic syndrome, that the obesity leads to this insulin resistance. And it's the number one cause of laminitis, I think, in all the horses that we see out there. And so that's a chronic foot pain.
Wow. All right. Well, thanks so much for all that information.
Very
really
good.
Appreciate that.
Thank you. We'll go on here. We have somebody over in Lafayette, Indiana, on our toll-free line, line four. Hello.
Good morning. My question, briefly, a 14-year-old cat who has not had many problems, but this spring has developed a condition where she's pulling her hair. She's a fairly short-haired cat. Pulling it out in clumps, and we've tried everything as far as allergy, changing our diet, the litter box, the whole bit. One healthcare professional hinted at maybe she has a mental problem. Have you ever heard of such a thing?
Tell me, if you could, a little bit more where the hair loss is occurring.
Primarily, it first started on the belly area, but now she's pulling at both of her front legs.
Okay.
Getting them. She's not bleeding, but she's getting all the hair off.
Okay. Is the skin, you mentioned it's not bleeding, but is she reddened or scabs or anything like that?
Yeah. No scabs yet, but I could see if she keeps it up, it couldn't be far away. They're very red. She just cleans herself constantly.
Okay. There is a, I guess you could call it a mental condition. Sometimes it's a psychosis or just a nervous continued. There's also an endocrine issue in the caudal or the lower abdomen between the legs, the groin region, if you will, that very often they will just clean totally of hair. Usually the skin is not irritated in those instances. This spring, as David was talking about much earlier, with the warm weather, the winter, and so forth, there's a lot more parasite problem. It's the type of thing that I would encourage you, maybe you've already been into your veterinarian, looking to see that there are no parasites. It doesn't sound like, from what you're describing, that that would be the typical thing. Classically, fleas would be over the tail head, the lower end of the back.
She is an indoor cat, and we still do treat her, though.
Okay.
Something would get through a screener, but anyhow.
Endocrine would be the type of issue that I would begin to think about from your description there.
Right, and the vet would know best on that, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay, thanks for your time.
All right,
thanks for the call. Well, here is a call or a question that's come in through the email. Someone who is listening and says that they have a dog, recently developed some odd behaviors, and the behavior was profusely licking his lips over and over again. They let him outside where he relieved himself and then proceeded to eat a lot of grass. And this concerned the person who was riding, tried to get them to stop, to come in the house. Dog ran away. And she says that, I know this behavior could be a sign of dog having upset stomach. The dog also had a lot of belching and flatulence. He reluctantly stopped eating the grass, came into the house. The flatulence continued the rest of the night. So the question is, what's going on here? Could he have possibly have gotten into something, eaten something that he shouldn't? Should I have taken him to the emergency vet? And the person says he's recovered, no longer doing this licking of the lips. But also the person says he doesn't really seem to be very interested in his food anymore. So, anything that you can say about that?
Well, I think the constellation of what's been observed there is a good one. The licking of lips, if you've ever kind of been nauseated, drooling, and just kind of not too sure if I'm going to be okay or not, the licking might be associated with that. I was thinking of something in the mouth. But then the eating of the grass, the belching, the flatulence, I definitely would be looking lower down. Lack of appetite now, I would be concerned that it could be something. I pulled a cork bottle, and I don't know where that came from, out of my dog's mouth last night, getting into something that's sitting in the stomach, sitting in the intestinal tract, causing problems. Without there actually being overt vomiting, sometimes can be a problem.
Huh, okay. So what would you, in that case, would you do x-ray or something like that?
Right. There's a couple of different things, certainly, that can be done. And x-ray sometimes would be beneficial, and ultrasound is another way. They show different things. If it's a metallic or a firm, hard object, x-rays will show up very easily. If it's a softer plastic, rubber piece of cork, as an example, then sometimes an ultrasound is a better way. And we don't know necessarily which one to start with, and it gets frustrating for everyone. If it's not reached, fortunately, an emergency situation, just make a routine appointment. Getting in to see someone on an emergency basis, especially if vomiting and continued inappetence or lack of appetite, and if weight loss is definitely observed, if you really know your weight and the dog has lost, cat's lost weight, I would get them in to be seen.
All right. Hope that helps. And let's go to another caller in Urbana. This is line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi. I have a cat who has a tear duct that keeps getting plugged up, and it'll scab over a little bit, and then it'll, you know, the scab will come off, and then it'll start happening again. And I went to the vet, and he gave me some stuff to smear on his eye, but he didn't like that at all. And I'm just wondering, I mean, he's had this on and off ever since I've had him, so I don't know. And he's gone through a round of antibiotics now, and should I keep worrying about this?
And how old is he?
He's about 4 or 5.
About 4. And he's had this since you got him at what age?
I think I got him when he was like 1.5.
Okay. And it's always been the same eye, scabbing, mm-hmm. scabbing over.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not an ophthalmologist. I'll start right there.
Okay.
We do have 2 board-certified ophthalmologists at the university. You said you'd been into your vet, and the routine treatments at this point doesn't sound as though they've been successful in relieving this.
Right.
We do see situations where the tear duct hasn't developed correctly. The scabbing is a little different, however, and that kind of concerns me as to what's going on. Since it's been this duration of time, I would be looking at something, thinking of something more developmental that's persisted, as opposed to, gee, this just started a week ago, then
right.
trauma or something worse maybe would be a concern possibly.
Okay. I'll get him again. Thank you.
All right.
Thank you. And we certainly have time for maybe one or two further questions. We'll be here for about another 5 minutes in this hour of focus. It's a program that we try to do occasionally to give you the chance to ask questions about the animals in your lives. We have two guests with us. They're both with the U of I College of Vet Medicine, Drs. Scott Austin and Brendan McKiernan. Something that just kind of popped up into my mind, and I'd been meaning to try to get back to this, is the idea that with animals that there can be a problem and it can go for a long time without any very dramatic observable symptoms. And that's right. Unfortunately, that seems to be the way it is, that before a cat or a dog really starts to show that there's something wrong, something could be really pretty advanced. Now, I don't know if as a person who lives with an animal, there's very much you can do very much about that. Are there particular things that you would say people should pay attention to that, you know, could get by you, but if you were really watching, maybe you would pick up on?
Sure, good question, and I'm sure that Scott could chip in here too, but. We talked about some of these, and maybe it's good to summarize them. We've already mentioned, actually, a few. Exercise intolerance. Well, I hear he's not doing as much, but he's older. Well, it may indeed be that he's become arthritic. He is a little bit older, and that's the reason. It may be that he's overweight and kind of complicates an arthritic situation that's mild. It may be that it's a harbinger of this is a respiratory or a cardiac issue. So changes in habit, not eating as much. The last caller said wasn't eating as much as usual. That's different. An increase in activity, increased sneezing. Sneezing is normal, but a constant sneezing, something's going on. Constant coughing. Those kinds of changes in behavior, I think, are what we need to look for. We mentioned sleeping and a respiratory rate for the respiratory system. Those kinds of things are really what you need to pay attention to. And just don't assume that, oh, they're older, they're not as active, that's the reason. It may be. Maybe that's the reason. But there may also be an underlying cause. You're very correct, because people will come in with a severe problem and say, how did this happen? Well, it's been developing, and it got to a point because dogs and cats cover up. They're not an athlete where we'd recognize a minor problem right away. And it takes a lot of change sometimes before it becomes obviously apparent. And then the disease, as you said, David, is progressed.
Yeah,
I would agree that any time that signs persist for several weeks, and they may not be that severe, but it's outside of the normal range, that a lot of what I do in my profession is preventative medicine. And so seeing them, at least evaluating and trying to decide if there is a problem, it's a lot easier at that stage to keep them going and keep them comfortable.
Mm-hmm. A lot of what we see is through our emergency room. We're 24/7. Mm-hmm. Someone's there all the time. When, unfortunately, it reaches that crisis, or if it's just, I'm uncertain, we have urgent care for us when we go in. Last week, I was on my way over there for an issue. But we have the emergency people that are there 24/7 every day, specialists on call, all the services available if needed to look at these things.
So that's I think that's a good point, that people should keep that in mind. If they do have a veterinary emergency, they can bring their animals to you.
Absolutely.
If they're not exactly sure what to do, there's also a place that they can call and talk with somebody about what's going on.
Call in, and obviously if we can give you some advice over the phone, someone's going to be able to talk to you, find out, just as we did, what's the history. It's an older animal, it's a younger animal, it's a tearing problem, it's a cough. Does this sound severe? If it doesn't sound too bad to us, we're going to recommend that probably make an appointment with your veterinarian. if it's an issue that we're not certain, the safest thing is let's check it out. Let's be sure. Clearly a hit by a car, a trauma case. We need to see you now.
Yeah. Well, we're down to the point where we have about maybe a minute or so left. Is there anything in particular that you might like to mention, either something that's seasonal or something that you think it's a good thing for people to know about?
Well, I think one of the important things, this is the time of year where we vaccinate for a lot of the diseases that are out there. Most of our diseases are mosquito carried. Uh-huh. And so before the mosquito season takes off, vaccinate for sleeping sickness, West Nile, tetanus.
This is horses we're talking about.
Yep, we're talking the horses, and so we want to vaccinate for these things before the mosquito season starts. Yeah. And so now's the time of year that we want to have our wellness visits, check the teeth, look at the body condition, talk about diet, and do all the things that we need to do, take care of parasites.
Yeah, I don't know, maybe heartworm, you might want to say something about that.
Heartworm in dogs, absolutely. Flea tick control, this is, again, this winter has been very mild, and it's running rampant. Not rampant, but there's a lot of it out there, more than this time of last year. Heartworm, they should be at this point in time, definitely on heartworm preventative, if they've been cleared, tested, and are negative.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I think at that, we're going to have to say we'll wrap it up for this time around. And again, to remind people that a good source of information, assistance, is the University of Illinois Vet Medicine Clinic, and that you can get emergency advice there. If you have a problem, you can bring your animal, you can call. It's a good resource for people in the community to keep in mind.
Right.
All right.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks, David.
Our guests, Dr. Brendan McKiernan. He is the director of the U of I Veterinary Teaching Hospital, and also Scott Austin. He's an assistant professor of veterinary clinical medicine in the College of Vet Medicine.